Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in the show, we'll discuss the frontline documentary Baby Brokers, which exposes the lucrative and shadowy world of the multi-billion dollar adoption industry in the United States. First, we're discussing the extraordinary prison sentences handed down to nine anti-ICE protesters in North Texas. The Justice Department accused the protesters of having ties to Antifa. Last month, they received federal prison sentences ranging from 30 to 100 years. One defendant, whom prosecutors acknowledged was not present at the protest, received a 30-year sentence for moving anti-fascist zines out of his apartment. FBI records obtained by today's guest, Adam Fetterman, for type investigations and in these times undercuts the government's portrayal of Antifa as an existential national security threat. Several defense attorneys involved in the case say those records should have been disclosed during the discovery process. So what does this case tell us about the criminalization of protests and dissent in this country? And could it become a model for prosecuting other activists? How are major media outlets covering this case? Adam Fetterman is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations who has written for many publications. You can find his piece on our website, kalw.org, click news, and your call. It's called FBI Files Counter-Government Argument in Texas Antifa Trial. Hi, Adam. Thank you so much for joining us. Hello, Adam. Are you with us?
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. So, Adam, before we talk about the Prairieland protesters, I want to briefly talk about Lorenzo Salgado Araujo, a 52-year-old man who came to the United States in the early 1990s from Mexico. He worked in the Houston area for decades. On Tuesday morning at 7 a.m., he left his home to pick up coworkers to head to a construction site, but he did not make it. He was shot and killed by an ICE agent in an unmarked car. The New York Times reports that details are still murky, but we now know that ICE agents were searching for a different person. Lorenzo Salgado's wife is now without a husband, and his three children are without their father. And I want to play a clip from his son, Ronaldo Salgado.
I am calling for a full investigation into the events that transpired yesterday, July 7th. He did not deserve to die. He did not deserve to be reduced to a headline of Mexican man shot and killed by ICE. I stayed on site for hours, talking to officers or anyone who can give me any answers. I learned of my father's passing from a news report on social media, not the hospital, not law enforcement. Through a collective effort from local organizations and elected officials, we got answers. My father's death was confirmed.
What happened to taking the murderers out? What happened to taking the rapists out? What happened to taking the drug dealers down? Not innocent people. That's not what you said, President Trump. You didn't say that.
And we should say that according to so much data, including from the Cato Institute, the overwhelming majority of people who are being violently arrested, detained, and deported do not have a criminal record. Just a little bit more information about where we are right now. According to the New York Times, ICE recently detained more than 10,000 people over a five-day period. Agents have been told to arrest 2,000 people a day. There have been arrest increases in many parts of the country, including Chicago and Sacramento. And then we're learning that hundreds of thousands of immigrant children facing deportation orders are having to represent themselves in court. That is according to the Vera Institute of Justice and DropSite News. They looked at federal immigration data that showed more than 400,000 immigrant children have been forced to appear in court without legal representation. So before we talk about this case, Adam, I think it's so important to just talk about where we are right now with ICE.
I mean, it's breathtaking to hear that list of just events that occurred in recent days. It's breaking and it's shocking, I think, even though we've sort of been living under this cloud of ICE, you know, repression and occupation of American cities. You know, this has been a slow moving disaster, really, since Trump took office. And I think it is worth just acknowledging the fact that in many ways, this is the centerpiece of his administration, of its policy, of its approach to domestic politics. And I know we're going to talk about Prairie Land later, but of course, you know, that protest was, you know, outside of an immigration detention center in Texas. And I think that what we're seeing now is a kind of merging of the administration's targeting of immigrants, and in some cases, killing them in broad daylight, and of a crackdown on lawful protest, and in some cases, killing of U.S. citizens who are engaged in protected speech and protest. I mean, we know that Alex Preti and Renee Good were shot and killed by ICE agents, even though they, you know, video evidence suggests that they were engaging in First Amendment protected activity, even if they were, you know, breaking the law in some way, trespassing, or those are not grounds to shoot people. I think in some ways, the fact that we're having this conversation is a reflection of just how sort of the world is in which we live.
And it's just, that's so devastating to learn about the case of Lorenzo Salgado Araujo. To think that his wife and his kids were not able to say goodbye to him, and now they are learning. Well, we should also say they learned about this online. You can't even imagine what that's like. And now they're learning that ICE went after the wrong man. Adam, what about accountability here?
Well, I think it's worth pointing out the fact that ICE seems to be operating in a kind of disorganized, is there a lack of accountability? There seems to be a lack of training, a lack of leadership, a lack of standards that I would hope most individuals who are part of the law enforcement community would reject and acknowledge our you know, completely uncalled for and beyond the pale. To target the wrong individual, of course, on its own is a mistake, and then to shoot that individual, there appears to be little evidence to support ICE's claim that their, you know, vehicles were rammed or encroached in any way. And you know, we saw this kind of thing with Alex Preti and Renee Good as well. The administration who characterized these people as dangerous, violent criminals, and that
Adam, we're having a hard time with your connection. So these, we're going to either call you, or if you can join Zoom by phone, that would be great. We're speaking right now with Adam Fetterman, a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. The piece that I mentioned from the New York Times really does deserve more attention. It is about the 10,000 ICE arrests that happened over a 5-day period. We're going to be doing a show about this. The New York Times reports that agents have been told to arrest 2,000 people a day. You can find that at the New York Times. And then the case that I mentioned, the horrific case about Lorenzo Salgado Araujo, this shooting and killing happened on Tuesday. We were waiting for more details. ICE said that they just didn't have video. And so a number of reporters have done a really good job of trying to figure out what happened to this 52-year-old father and husband. Now we are learning that ICE went after the wrong person, but the New York Times is reporting that the details are still murky. So we wanted to bring you that context before we dive in and talk about what happened with these Prairie Land protesters. So just to give you some information about this, because so much is happening and it's very hard to follow all of this, given that so much information is happening so quickly. So I want to read from Sam Levine's piece in The Guardian, June 23rd. A group of Texas protesters convicted of terrorism charges received unusually harsh sentences in a closely watched case that was widely seen as a test case of the Trump administration's efforts to crack down on dissent. After a three-week jury trial, the nine activists were all found guilty of a slew of criminal charges in March, stemming from a 4th of July protest at an immigrant detention facility in Alvarado, Texas, south of Fort Worth. The demonstrators arrived late at night with a plan to set off fireworks as part of a noise demonstration to show solidarity with those detained inside. A few of the protesters spontaneously broke off from the main group and vandalized cars in the parking lot, a guard shack, slashed the tires on a government van, and broke a security camera. When a police officer arrived on the scene and drew his weapon, one of the activists fired an AR-15, hitting the officer in the shoulder. The officer survived. Benjamin Song, who fired the gun at the police officer, was sentenced to 100 years in prison. Song was convicted of attempted murder of an officer of the United States, as well as firearm and explosive charges. He was also convicted of riot, providing material to support terrorists. He faced anywhere from 20 years to life in prison. Zachary Evitz, Autumn Hill, Savannah Batten, Elizabeth Soto, and Megan Morris were sentenced to 50 years in prison. Maricela Rueda, another demonstrator, was sentenced to 70 years in prison. All six were convicted of riot, providing material support to terrorists, and explosive charges. Rueda was also convicted of corruptly concealing a document or record. Evitz, Hill, Morris, and Rueda were acquitted on attempted murder and firearm charges. The sentences handed down were unusually long, said Barbara McQuaid, a former federal prosecutor who served as the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan during the Obama administration. She said, more often, judges will sentence defendants for separate counts concurrently. Here, it appears that the judge stacked the sentences for each count consecutively. I would have expected lengthy sentences here, more in the ballpark of 15 to 25 years, but nothing like 50 to 100 years. And the Trump administration praised the sentences. So I was reading there from Sam Levine's piece in The Guardian about the Prairie Land protesters. And I believe that we have Adam now on the phone. Hi, Adam. Are you with us again?
Yes, I'm back. I hope the connection is better.
Okay, let's hope. So I read from the Guardian piece just to give a little bit of background. First off, what else can you tell us about this detention center in Texas?
Well, it had become notorious, even within the network of detention centers in Texas for its conditions immigrants were being held. I believe early on during this, Trump's second term, immigrants who were being deported to countries in South America were being held at Prairie Land. So it had a somewhat higher profile than some of the other facilities in Texas, which is why activists singled it out. And, on July 4th of last year, when they held this noise demonstration, they had also held a larger protest during the day at the same facility. So it was certainly, on the map of the activist community and protesters in Texas, and it was where they ultimately staged the noise demo on the night of July 4th.
As you report, at least one protester spray painted a guard shack and a vehicle in the Prairie Land parking lot with expletives and anti-ICE slogans. They dismantled the security camera. Some of the protesters had firearms, which in Texas, an open carry state, is generally legal. When a police officer arrived on scene and pulled his gun, allegedly pointing it at someone running away from him, one of the protesters fired an AR-15 style rifle in the officer's direction. The officer was hit just below the neck and suffered minor injuries. That night and in the weeks that followed, the FBI and state law enforcement raided activist homes and arrested 19 people. So just to give people background, is there anything else we need to know about what happened that night?
Well, there are a couple of things. I mean, one thing I would point out is that Benjamin Song, the 32-year-old former Marine reservist who fired the weapon, you know, he was not apprehended on the night of July 4th. So he was at large for almost 2 weeks, which precipitated this FBI and law enforcement sweep of the activist community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which included a number of home raids, confiscation of cell phones and computers, and kind of a widening dragnet related to the protest. And as you just noted, you know, I think at least 19, that number may be higher now, individuals have been arrested and charged in relation to the Prairie Land protest. The only other thing I would add is that Song's defense in their closing argument presented some new theories about the bullet and the possibility that it may have ricocheted off of the ground or a hard object before striking the officer. And they actually argued that Song was firing suppressive shots into the ground rather than aiming at the officer. And that is an issue that may come up in appeal.
Tell us about the role that Antifa has played in this case. You write that on the last day of testimony in this trial, the government called its star witness to the stand, Kyle Shuttler, director of counterterrorism research at the right-wing think tank Center for Security Policy, had been key to the prosecution's case that Antifa is a violent criminal organization bent on overthrowing the government. Shuttler, an imposing figure, had attended nearly the entire trial, sitting in the overflow room during jury selection. He read aloud the government's definition of Antifa, as well as an excerpt from Trump's executive order declaring Antifa a domestic terrorist organization. Tell us more about the role Antifa played in this case.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to overstate the significance of Antifa in the trial and in the administration's attempt to create a kind of all-encompassing threat that falls under this umbrella. I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, this protest and the initial arrests, of course, took place in July 2025, but it wasn't until after the assassination of Charlie Kirk in September and the executive order declaring Antifa a domestic terrorist organization, and then the National Security Presidential Memo further articulating the administration's approach to Antifa and the left, that the Prairie Land trial sort of became the administration's, you know, way of prosecuting Antifa. So it was a sort of a retroactive effort to use this particular set of events to advance their claims about Antifa, you know, which we've seen them kind of continue to build as a central narrative of, you know, their political project.
On today's Media Roundtable, we're speaking with Adam Fetterman, a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, who's out with a piece called FBI Files Counter-Government Argument in Texas Antifa Trial, FOIA records obtained by Type Investigations and in these times raise questions about the evidence presented in this Prairie Land case. So tell us about the records that you obtained, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth pointing out just that there were a lot of issues with the way that this trial was handled in terms of evidence that was allowed in discovery, evidence that was withheld, decisions made by the judge, which kind of dictated what the defense was allowed to use in its arguments. And of course, the records that I obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request essentially show that the FBI had conducted an investigation of Antifa Dallas-Fort Worth beginning probably in 2017 and concluded that the group posed no threat to national security and was not engaged in any kind of criminal activity. Now, of course, it was 6 years before the Prairie Land protest, but the significance is that, you know, the government and prosecution's case is built around the idea that Antifa poses a threat to national security, is essentially a terrorist organization. And the FBI investigation reaching a completely different conclusion would have been material to the defense. And the fact that the Department of Justice and the FBI, either willingly or unwillingly, it really doesn't matter legally, did not include these records in discovery, is problematic, to say the least. And it's just the tip of the iceberg, because there are additional records that the FBI has not yet released, and which I'm suing to compel the agency to disclose.
What are you hearing from lawyers about these very long sentences?
Unprecedented, certainly sentences that do not fit the crimes or activities that took place in and around the event. I think the stiffest sentence in the January 6th riot cases, which of course have all been basically pardoned, was something like 22 years for the leader of the Proud Boys. I think if you look at what happened on the night of July 4, 2025, and what these individuals were doing, it's hard to square that with the sentences that were handed down.
You quoted Leslie Pamplin in your piece, an attorney who was part of Maricela Rueda's defense team, who said, "This case was overcharged. This is not a riot compared to January 6th. This was brought because Trump wanted it brought." What precedent does this case set for future protesters?
Well, I mean, I think it's something that activists and protesters are going to have to keep in mind when they engage in direct action. And it's not just the Prairie Land trial. It's what's happening in Minnesota with the indictment of 15 activists and organizers there on very thin charges. These are groups that engage in various forms of community organizing and nonviolent direct action. If that can land you in prison for 50 to 70 years, it's going to certainly change the calculation. And that's exactly what it's designed to do. I mean, the Trump administration is using scare tactics, intimidation, and the machinery of the state to effectively try to silence its opponents.
What do you think about how major media outlets are talking about what this case means for activists and protesters? The Guardian has a piece looking at that. Truth Out, Democracy Now!, The Verge has an interesting piece about how digital surveillance is being used for cases like this. What are your thoughts about major media coverage?
Well, I think, the big outlets have tended to keep a distance from the left and organized protest over the years. That's something that I've been covering and writing about for more than a decade. I don't think they take it that seriously. I think we've seen the steady erosion of the right to protest going back to really the campaigns to target Keystone Pipeline and Dakota Access Pipeline in the 2010s. And then legislation that's been passed in many states to make that kind of activity much riskier and difficult. I think that we need more coverage of these stories, not just when, there's a draconian sentence handed down or a conviction, but, sustained attention to sort of what's happening out on the ground and in this country.
And to your point, the independent media has really been all over this. Here's a piece from Matt Sledge in The Intercept, June 23rd. Daniel Sanchez Estrada was not accused of attempted murder or material support of terrorism after a protest turned catastrophically wrong outside of this detention center in Texas. He was merely convicted of obstructing the investigation by moving a box full of anti-fascist zines after the protest. Giving him a long prison term would make a mockery of justice, his defense attorney said. The punishment must fit the crime, not the headline. The judge gave him a 30-year term for moving a box of anti-fascist zines.
Yeah, it's really unfathomable. He wasn't at the protest. He moved these political pamphlets. His wife was involved in the protest and had called him from prison. And after that, he moved the box of, I think it's worth just stating the obvious, which is that the zines are in no way evidence of any kind of crime. They're a reflection of a political, a system of political beliefs and ideas, and they're common at, you know, anarchist bookstores and protests, you know, across the country. So to use this as evidence of a crime is of course, sort of another level. And, you know, his case has probably gotten more attention than most of the other defendants. But, you know, I think that the Trump administration is really just beginning to use these kinds of charges to go after the left. And that's what we're seeing in Minnesota. And, you know, I would bet that we'll see more in the weeks and months to come.
And at least four of these defendants are appealing. What have lawyers said about the appeals?
Yes, I would expect them all to appeal. I don't have confirmation of that yet. You know, there hasn't been, the lawyers have been relatively quiet thus far, and I'm assuming that they're coming up with some sort of a strategy in terms of how to appeal these sentences. They will go before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one of the most conservative, if not the most conservative in the country. You know, I think they do have a lot of material to use, including the fact that key information was withheld from discovery or left out of the trial altogether. So I'm sure that the charges and sentences will be appealed, but, you know, that will take quite some time.
Adam Fetterman is a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. You can find his piece on our website, klw.org. Click news and your call. It's called FBI Files Counter Government Argument in Texas Antifa Trial. Adam, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about Baby Brokers, a Frontline Retro Report documentary investigating how lucrative for-profit adoption agencies and brokers have targeted pregnant women and families hoping to adopt. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.